Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates, episode by episode, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which ran on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Corporal Captain Rob Kelly, and joining us back in the VIP tent this week is Major Max Romero. Hi, Max.
Hey, Rob.
I am very excited to have you back here for Season 2 of MASHcast. We're here to talk about Season 2, Episode 26, 5 O'Clock Charlie. And before we get to the episode in question, I do need to say, when I sent out the feelers to everybody about what episodes they wanted to come on and talk with me about for Season 2, there was virtually no list that did not include 5 O'Clock Charlie. This is wow. This is clearly a favorite. Now, luckily, Max Venmo'd me some cheddar, and so here we are. So I'm happy to have you on, Max. This is a really great episode.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, and I think probably the reason you had so many people requesting to be on the show, doing this this episode in particular, is because it's very memorable because it is just so weird. It's just such an odd idea.
It is very, very strange. We'll get into, and of course, it has some real life inspiration, but we'll get to that in a moment. So, this episode aired on September 22nd, 1973, written by Larry Gelbart, Lawrence Marks, and Keith Walker, directed by Norman Tokar. The 477th is giddy with anticipation for the arrival of 5 O'Clock Charlie is imminent. 5 O'Clock Charlie is North Korean's most indefatigable bomber pilot, who flies over the camp the same time every day, hence the name, and drops one bomb in a pathetic attempt to destroy the camp and a nearby ammo dump. His aim is terrible, and he always misses, so no one at the 47th is particularly worried. Except for Frank and Hot Lips, of course, who are apoplectic over everyone's lack of seriousness. This is an enemy attack. Radar takes bets on where Charlie's bomb for the day will land, and on this particular day, Henry wins the bet. He's busy counting his pot of cash when Frank requests he place a call to General Clayton. Before he knows it, Henry is requesting that the 477th get a 40mm gun to fight off the enemy, something Hawkeye and Trapper are completely against. Clayton decides to visit the camp and check it out for himself, and initially he doesn't think the 477 needs the gun. Hawkeye and Trapper are relieved until 5 O'Clock Charlie gets lucky and drops a bomb right on Clayton's Jeep. The 477th is getting its gun. Frank, of course, loves it and even forms his own platoon, consisting all of three soldiers, to provide defense against 5 O'Clock Charlie's attacks, hoping the army will start outfitting all the field hospitals with artillery. Hawkeye, Trapper, dressed as MacArthur, and Radar combine goof on Frank just to irritate him. That night, Hawkeye and Trapper drown their sorrows with Captain Cardozo, the camp's dentist. Cardozo offers the idea that they should try and get rid of the ammo dump, which would get rid of Charlie, which would get rid of the gun. The next day, Hawkeye and Trapper leave a series of giant arrows made up of sheets stolen from supply, pointing to the ammo dump so Charlie can't miss it. To give him time to try and hit it, they mess with the clocks in post-op, so Frank thinks it's 4:30, not 5 o'clock. Frank catches on and hurries outside to fire at Charlie. Hawkeye and Trapper make shambles of the attempt, yelling out different numbers randomly, confusing the soldiers Frank has aiming the gun. Frank, frustrated and impatient, finally demands they fire, and they do, missing Charlie entirely, instead hitting the ammo dump. With the ammo dump gone, so is the need for the gun, and so is 5 O'Clock Charlie, who Hawkeye and Trapper admit to sort of missing. So, Max, like, this one, I don't know, I think this is a straight-up classic. Like, this is a flawless episode.
It really is, and it's interesting because I think a lot of people who come to MASH later or maybe watched it in syndication, like, I talked about this before. I watched it with my mom when it would come out every week. But a lot of this episode came out in 73. I was 3 years old at the time. So, obviously, I didn't watch it then. But MASH has this kind of reputation of being almost a dramedy, I guess, of tackling serious issues and talking and having very dramatic episodes and storylines. And this one is pretty much straight ahead a gag.
Yes.
And it works really well on that level.
It's nice to see everybody. The episode opens with Hawkeye and Trapper, like, in their, like, Hawkeye has, like, his pith helmet on, and yeah, they're doing this faux British thing where he's like, I'll say, let's toddle off, and they're doing, and it's
terrible accent.
Terrible accent. And it's fun to watch them have fun. You know, we all know that they hate being at the 477th, but in this moment, they're kind of enjoying it. It's almost like a vacation. They have their beach chairs and they have their bets, and everybody's just having good, and everybody's excited about 5 o'clock Charlie coming. So it's fun to watch them have fun. And I love the runners that Frank has got his gun, and they keep substituting stuff in his gun. And like, you know, they do that one point where Frank shoots his gun in the air and what, you know, liquid comes out,
pistol,
and he's like, "Who put water in my gun?" And you hear Hawkeye say, "How do you know it's water?" Which I love that gag.
Yeah, it's a great running gag. I think later it's like a Joker style pistol that says
right.
"Bang."
Yeah.
There's a small plunger at one point.
They replace it with a stapler at one point. Here, our money, Mister. Don't staple us. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a great episode, and it kind of alludes to something that they would hit on in later episodes, and you hear this about serving in the military and serving even in a theater of war, where there is downtime and sometimes a lot of downtime, where the soldiers or the people who are there are just kind of bored,
right?
And so I think for the 477th, 5 o'clock Charlie, like you said. It's just kind of this bright spot in being stuck in the Korean War, because as you said, he has this apparently awful plane that just like barely stays in the sky.
Oh, yeah, it's like an old biplane. Yeah,
it just kind of chugs along.
Snoopy and the Red Baron, practically.
Yeah, and when he drops a bomb, he's dropping it, you know, old style. He's actually like lifting a small bomb out and dropping it over the side.
We see a guy literally throwing a bomb, like pulls it out of his lap and throws it.
Yeah, and you know, and they say, oh, it's because we have an ammo dump, and if we got rid of the ammo dump, you know, we wouldn't have to worry about 5 o'clock Charlie. And you know, there's a whole thing about why there's an ammo dump in the first place, and you know, but yeah, it's so silly that I can see how something like that could happen. You know, I could see how that would be something that you're just bored. And something unusual is happening, and of course you take bets on it. Why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, why not? You got to do something. I mean, again, unless there was there's drinking. I mean, what else are you going to do in the middle of South Korea in 1952 or whatever it is? I mean, there's drinking. I guess there's fooling around, but short of that, there's probably not, and they're gambling. I guess. I mean, that's why they play they play card games. But I mean, other than that, there's not a lot to do. So yeah, 5 o'clock Charlie is like a TV show. It's like a TV show that's on every day at 5 o'clock, and they come. I do love how much effort they make, considering how short the show is. I mean, like Charlie's whole visit is like 45 seconds, and yet they're bringing beach chairs and umbrellas, and they really do like
a thermos full of booze.
Yeah, they got, right. They got their snifters, whatever. One of the themes that I do like that is layered in this episode is that the idea of these people are there to do. Are there on a mission of mercy? And if you start putting in weaponry, then you are altering their mission. And, you know, every country that participates in a war does operate ostensibly by some code of conduct, you know, and you're not supposed to bomb hospitals. Like that's completely, you know, you will answer to that. If it turns out you did something like that, you're supposed to bomb prisoners, you know, civilians, stuff like that. Of course, America has done all of that. But the idea is that, like, to someone like Frank Burns, he sees no problem melding weapons of war and hospitals. And of course, to someone like Hawkeye, who, as he said in a later episode, "I will not inflict their wounds," that's completely horrifying to him. And on a strategy level, it makes no sense, because as they even literally say to Frank, if you start really arming us, we're going to get real planes coming by and bombing us, like MiGs.
Right.
And he's like, "Is that what you want?" And Frank, of course, is an idiot and doesn't want to hear it. And so I like that there is a serious point buried in the silliness of this episode, is that it's like, yeah, hospitals are not supposed to engage in that. And even by having an ammo dump, even at a hospital, is probably kind of bad form, really, because even that's kind of cheating.
Yeah. They say something about having an ammo dump nearby. A hospital is supposed to be, I guess, more attractive so that it protects the hospital, is what they're saying. But yeah, it's that kind of military mindset of that people talk about sometimes, where things don't always make sense, you know.
Right.
That's an interesting thing you brought up about Frank, and it's something that's consistent in his character. Is Frank is a doctor, you know, air quotes, and he desperately wants to be a soldier, you know, yes. And that pops up now and then, and that is why because he goes to Henry with a booklet of exactly the gun that he wants,
which is initially upside down because it's a 04WW Nug.
What's Nug? A, we what's need a Nug? Nug.
What's a Nug? Oh, flips the books upside down. That's a gun, sir.
But you know, of course, he's Frank, and he's as incompetent at that as he is at surgery.
Yeah, and he wants to be a soldier, but he would never actually be at a war because he's too chicken shit for that too. Like, right. As we know, he wants the Purple Heart, but he doesn't want to do anything for it. You know, right. he just wants the fame and the glory, unlike any other real politician I could name. There is also another recurring thing with Frank in this episode where he talks about someday all of this is going to come out. He says that. Mm-hmm. He says that in numerous episodes. And in later on in that episode, The Interview, he talks about how he thinks he might write a book about his experiences on MASH. And when you've watched MASH as much as I have, you know, you can't help but like start imagining what happens to the characters after they went home. Yeah. And I've always imagined that Frank Burns went home and wrote a book, like wrote one of these total like pro McCarthy, pro communist witch hunt, you know, completely divorced from reality kind of books. Right. that got maybe people in trouble because he was talked about what an un-American, you know, pro North Korean, pro commie, pro pinko attitude prevailed at the 477. But he does it in enough episodes that I have to think the writers kept that going as like a little piece of character business for Frank Burns. That he one day all this is going
to
come out.
Yeah, you know, and that goes to Frank's character too of being like, you can see him being like a little snitch.
Oh,
you know, he's like, well, someday you'll get yours. You know, it's a good Frank episode. You know, and I like Frank. I mean, I wouldn't want to hang out with the character of Frank, but I like watching Frank in MASH.
Oh yeah,
because he's such an interesting character. You know, a lot of it seems very surface level, but like you said, you know, he drops these little things that make you wonder about him, and you know, he just so desperately wants to be a part of something.
Yeah,
and that shows up at the end of the episode, but it's just this whole the whole episode is structured like a farce. You know, but like you said, there's also some real danger because, you know, they're worried about attracting MIGs, which would actually hit the target. And they're even kind of worried about Charlie because they don't want him shot out of the sky by Frank.
Yeah, they like Charlie. Yeah. They figure he's harmless. So, I mean,
Yeah. I mean, and then as you mentioned, you know, they're all betting on him. And General Clayton comes down. But before that, he's talking to General Clayton on the phone, and General Clayton is placing bets.
Right, yeah. I love that Radar even argues. He's like, what do you want? He's like, 162 yards. He's like, that's what you have. Just give it to him. Even Radar is very, very upset about the integrity of his betting sheet.
Right. Yeah, and I love that Radar is the one taking the bets.
Yeah, of course. He's organizing all this. Now, I did mention, this is based on a real guy. The idea for this episode was based on the activity of a real Japanese pilot during World War II who would harass the U.S. Marines on Guadalcanal. The pilot would fly over Marine encampments at night in order to deprive them of much-needed sleep. Sometimes he would drop a bomb. Other times he would just fly over them. The Marines nicknamed him Washing Machine Charlie. And like 5 o'clock Charlie, his plane's engine was always out of timing. So that's what that was. So, yeah, based on a real – I mean, yeah, this was probably just some research that Larry Gelbart did. I mean, Larry Gelbart served in World War II, so maybe he even knew about it from that point. But, yeah, I do love that General Clayton is in on it. That's very funny. He doesn't take it as seriously as Frank Burns takes it, you know?
No, not until he blows up his Jeep.
Not until he blows up his Jeep. And it's funny. If you watch the episode very carefully, you will see when Clayton's Jeep gets blown up, it's already pre-blown up. It's already a smoldering wreckage. So I have to assume that this was the second take and they only had the money for one Jeep to get blown up. So they just blew it up the first time, and then for whatever reason they couldn't use that take. So they blew it up again, and they figured they would edit it tight enough that you don't really notice. But you can see that when it bursts into flames, it's already it's already a pile of molten wreckage.
Right.
So obviously the MASH budget wasn't enough to keep blowing up. I guess they didn't have a lot of Jeeps laying around that they could dispense of. There is a couple of significant things in the history of the show. This episode features the first appearance of actor Jeff Maxwell, who would go on to play Private Igor Stravinsky. He's not credited here either as the actor or as Igor. They would later just establish that he was Igor. But you do see him here for the first time. Frank mentions Billy Mitchell, a real life person who was and says he was played by Gary Cooper. Gary Cooper starred in The Court Martial of Billy Mitchell, but that movie came out in 1955, 2 years after the Korean War ended. So once again, it's another movie that manages to get to the 477 long before it was ever produced. I love that very kind of Abbott and Costello who's on first routine that Henry and Frank have about Gary Cooper movies. Because
yes.
Of course Henry is talking about Sergeant York, and he's like, I thought Gary Cooper played Sergeant York. Well, he did, but he also played Billy Mitchell. And he also played Lou Gehrig. And he was for a very strong military. And then Henry's like, that's pretty surprising for a first baseman.
Oh, can I just wax Henry Blake's car for a second?
Oh, sure.
How great is McLean Stevenson as Henry? I mean, there's a reason he is beloved. I mean, both on the show and, you know, to fans. He is just so great I think McLean Stevenson got, he was one of the people who got his character right off the bat.
Yeah.
And it's just a joy to watch.
Oh, he's wonderful. I love the way all his lines, he's got the cigar in his mouth. So he's kind of constantly talking like that. I just love that. That was just like a funny bit. Yeah. It's the one moment though, I would say that is a little cringeworthy in this episode is Henry's, where he's performing surgery with Ginger Bayless. Yeah. And he asks Ginger what her number is. And she says, you know, I don't know, 82 yards. And he's like, 82 yards. And he's like, you're out of your mind. And then he keeps going almost as if, I almost feel like the director was almost told McLean Stevenson, well, just vamp a little. And he's like, you're out of your pretty little mind, Ginger. You're out of your pretty little mind. And he keeps like talking to her like she's a child. And you're like, ooh, that does not hold up well.
He keeps calling her honey.
Honey,
and,
yeah.
You got a pretty little mind. And yeah, it's kind of like, and especially considering that it's in the surgery.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, there's a, I think it starts when he asks for some instruments, and I guess she hands him two by mistake.
Yes, and he says you got two. Says, yeah, you got two here, honey, or something like that.
Yeah, and that's kind of like what? And then he kind of like it piles on, and yeah, that's a little. It doesn't hold up to today's standards.
It's a scene that feels very unfocused, and I wonder if the show was a little short. And so they just shot this as kind of a filler, and they just let McLean Stevenson vamp a little. I mentioned the director. This episode was directed by Norman Tokar, which I mentioned. This was his only episode of MASH, which is strange because he did a great job. He later went on to direct the Disney movie The Cat from Outer Space, which I saw in the theater when I was 8 years old with my mom, which also happened to star McLean Stevenson and Harry Morgan. So,
really?
Yes, you got a very strong MASH connection with that. I'm going to have to cover that on the show one of these times because it's got one of those connections. He also did the Apple Dumpling Gang for Disney, which also featured Harry Morgan. He did a lot of Disney. This is his only MASH credit, which is very strange. I mentioned the writers, Larry Gelbart, everybody knows who that is, and Lawrence Marks. But the other writer credited is Keith Walker. This is much like Norman Tokar, this is his only MASH credit, which is very strange to me because it's really funny. He wrote episodes of Emergency, The Fall Guy, and he wrote the basic story for Free Willy, of all things.
Wow.
So for every Free Willy movie, and there's like 9 of them now, he gets credit because they're characters created by Keith Walker. So I think Keith Walker has since passed away, but for a long time, he was getting that Free Willy money.
Yay, why not?
Good for him, man.
That's crazy that those people that this episode was their only credit. That's and especially considering, like you said, it's a classic episode.
Yeah, yeah. You would think that you would get a return gig. Everybody thought how well this turned out. The announcer, we hear the PA announcer. That is the voice of Todd Sussman. This is his first episode. Yeah. He would go on to be the PA announcer in 47 episodes of MASH all the way till 1979. He was never credited. Very strangely, never in a MASH episode does he ever get any credit. He is one of those jobbing actors. You've seen him in a billion things. He later appeared on MASH in an episode this season on camera. He is still working today. He's in episodes of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. He was in Orange is the New Black. He was did episodes of St. Elsewhere, ALF, Grease Under Fire, and he did an ER, which happened to also feature in a guest appearance Alan Alda. They don't have any scenes together, but they're both in this. They're both in one episode.
Oh wow, good for him!
Yeah, so that's cool. I love that. And then the other actor I want to mention playing Cordozo, the dentist, is Corey Fisher, who appeared in the MASH movie. He played Captain Bandini, one of the hangers-on. He has a lot of other, not a lot, but he had a bunch of other TV credits. But the credit I wanted to mention specifically was he was in an episode of All in the Family, and he's credited as Jesus Hippie, which is one of the great credits of all time. It's just, I love the fact that, you know, like he probably got a check that said, you know, like Jesus Hippie on it or something. Just love that.
Yeah, and that's an interesting character because he doesn't, does that character ever show up again?
The other dentists show up, but it's always a different dentist.
Yeah, because he is so unusual because he's just hanging out in the swamp.
And he's a hippie. While, he's a total hippie.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Because he's there strumming on a guitar and listening to Hawkeye and Trapper discuss, you know, what they're going to do about 5 o'clock, about Frank trying to blow 5 o'clock Charlie out of the sky. And he's just kind of sitting there, and you don't really ever see anyone in the swamp just kind of hanging out right. Unless they're there for a reason.
Right.
And especially not playing a guitar.
Yeah, and he's got this big bushy beard. I mean, he's no way would he be in the military with that facial hair.
No, he always, you know, he always, again, I was very young when I first saw these episodes, but he always makes me think of Shel Silverstein for some reason.
He looks like, except for the fact he's not bald. Yeah, he looks like Shel Silverstein. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, with the guitar and everything. Yeah, but it,
give us a few bars of A Boy Named Sue.
and it's just kind of weird. And they don't do that often. I actually can't think of another time that they do that, that someone's just there. But Cardoza is the one who actually gives them the idea of getting rid of the ammo dump.
Right. He drops the wisdom on them where he says, you can never get rid of people like Frank. His kind are invincible, and they always will be. And they're like, thanks, Phil. Like, that's a depressing thought. Unfortunately, Phil is completely right. You know? I mean, one of the other things that that Frank goes on and on again in this episode where he says, it's Pearl Harbor all over again. Yeah. And to kind of like not to make too serious a point, but it's like that's the mindset of like, yeah, we can all admit that what happened at Pearl Harbor was awful. It was a travesty. It was, you know, many bad things. But not everything after that is Pearl Harbor.
Right.
And we've seen that we have learned nothing from that. We've learned nothing. Because how many times post 9/11 has somebody tried to sell us that the next horrible thing is – it's another 9/11. It's like, no, it isn't. It, you know, calm down. But that's Frank. And Frank even gets in, they give Larry Linville a really pretty racist line at one point where he's talking to his squad and they're all Koreans. And he talks about that Charlie comes by the same time every day. There's no element of surprise. And he goes, which only shows you the limits of Oriental thinking. Right. And he realizes that he's saying it to an Asian man. And the guy just gives him like a weird look. And it's like, well, that's, you know, that's Frank.
Yeah, that is Frank. And, you know, and that's the difference between that scene and the scene with Henry and Ginger. Because with Henry and Ginger, that misogyny kind of comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And you know, obviously it's not appropriate, but it just doesn't make any sense in the conversation that they're having and what they're doing, which is operating on a patient. But with Frank, it makes total sense because that's the kind of jerk that Frank is. Yep. You know, and also, this comes right after the squad leader, you know, he makes him squad leader, tells him he speaks English and like three other languages.
Right. That guy's super, super capable.
Yeah, exactly. And meanwhile, you know, Frank is fiddling around and you know, and saying these bigoted things. And you know, I think that was kind of the point of setting it up that way, that Frank is just this, you know, small person. And for him to say, you know, it's Pearl Harbor all over again. The irony of that is that this is an American saying this in a country, in a foreign country, where they are at war. You know, if anyone in the Pearl Harbor metaphor here is the Japanese, it's Frank.
Yeah,
you know? And it's subtle, but it's really good. It's, you know, this, even for being a farce, this episode is, you know, saying quite a bit.
Yeah, and it says something about the inherent likability of Larry Linville, I think, as a performer, that he makes that, I don't want to say palatable, because it's not palatable, but he made Frank entertaining, and that you said you want to kind of watch him, even though he says terrible things, because otherwise, you know, if another actor had played it, it might make it unwatchable, that you just hate Frank so much that you can't stand it. But instead, he's funny, and it is helps that he's so hapless. I mean, they do the running gag again about the guns. He's got the plunger, and he's just such a pathetic moron that he's even though he's going to get everybody into trouble. Now, there was a weird line in this where they talk about that they're learning to store ammo near the camp, which we talked about, and Clayton says, we learned that from the Germans. And Hawkeye says, oh, great, we're taking lessons from the losers. And then they talk about Hermann Goering, and Henry has a line where he says, well, he also ate whole bakeries and wore tutus. And I was like, huh? What is it? So I looked that up, and I don't get where the ate whole bakeries thing came from. I guess the joke was that he was, like, obese. But from the pictures I saw of Hermann Goering, he wasn't, so I'm not sure what that was. But according to Wikipedia, Hermann Goering did like to dress up in all of his, like, frippery. And really loved dressing like a Nazi with all of his regalia. Yeah. He's like that sheriff out there. I forget the name of that guy. You know, the guy that wears like the 40,000 medals on his chest. They're all fake and shit. But apparently, at one point, he even went to some public event in a fur. He wore a fur coat. Oh, wow. And Foreign Minister Galeazzo Chiano noted that Goering wearing a fur coat looked like what a high grade prostitute wears to the opera. So now I don't know if that flat out means that he was a transvestite, which is what Henry is suggesting by saying he wore tutus, but maybe that's where they got that from, is that Hermann Goering kind of had a feminine side when he came to his
dress. I heard that line, but it didn't make any sense to me. And, but you know, of course, by that point, it's just a line that's dropped in and the scene keeps rolling.
Yeah. You just go. So,
I was just like, what? That makes a little more sense.
And speaking of a joke that I blew right by me for the first probably 5,000 times I saw this episode, when Hawkeye and Trapper and Radar come up and do their whole like vaudeville routine about face forward, bar, you know, and Trapper's playing MacArthur. He's got Hawkeye and Radar, and they're the squad. And Hawkeye has, I think, a golf club as his gun, and Radar, I think, might even literally have a gun or something like that.
No,
and
he has a yardstick.
Oh, he's a yardstick. Okay, of course. Radar would never have a gun. And so he's like, okay, about face. And then he goes, count off. And Hawkeye says, he says, count off. And then there's this awkward pause, and Radar is like waiting for Hawkeye to talk. And he goes, are you one? Yeah. And Hawkeye goes, yes, are you? And he says it in a very kind of like effeminate voice. For many years, I did not get that was supposed to be like a gay joke. That it was Radar sort of saying, like, Radar was being literal. Radar was saying, are you one and I'm two? And Hawkeye took it as, are you one? Like, it's a secret code. Are you one? Yes. And like when I was a kid, I totally didn't get that. It wasn't until later on I was like, oh, I see, Hawkeye. Because then, of course, Radar gets embarrassed because he says, like, knock it off or something like that.
So. When you're young, that's just a silly voice.
Yeah.
It's not until later that you learn the context of that. And it's something that you see it in TV of that era, and especially like in the early years of MASH, where there were certain things that were done that wouldn't fly today, or that they might think twice about doing.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting it's a snapshot, I think, of what was acceptable in that era. And I take it, you know, because the MASH was never or almost never mean.
Right.
And it was never, it never attacked groups of people that were being essentially undermined by society. But I took that to mean almost that, and still today, it's much more open than it used to be. But I mean, I grew up in the 70s and the 80s, and I remember that being a gay person who was out was something that very rarely happened.
Yeah.
And there are, I assume still, I don't know, but there were code words and, you know, ways to, you know, find like-minded people, you know, find people, you know, like yourself. And, you know, I could totally see where someone would say that and take it, like you said, as like almost like a code word.
Yep.
Especially in the Army.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you would have been completely thrown out. In fact, MASH will do an episode about that very subject later on this season. They will confront that head on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I never took it as it was not a – it's not a – I mean, I guess you could argue that doing the effeminate voice is a little derogatory, but I just took it as more of it's – they're leaning into a stereotype as opposed – but they're not saying anything mean about it. They're not – it's not making fun of gay people. It's more just kind of a joke about a code. And, of course, that makes Radar very uncomfortable because Radar is a farm boy from, you know, 1940s Iowa. He doesn't know.
Yeah, which is really the joke. It's just, you know, they're always trying to make Radar uncomfortable.
Right, exactly.
One way or another.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great bit of kind of Charlie Chaplin or Abbott Costello-esque, you know, total farce of just them goofing around and about face, you cut that out, face, fall, you know. And of course, you know, Wayne Rogers looks great in his aviator glasses with his corncob pipe doing his MacArthur. So, yeah,
his short pants,
yeah. It's a fantastic episode from beginning to end. I would argue that there is not a single bad episode in season two of MASH. I think starting with the first one, Divided We Stand, they just hit the – were just on a rocket at that point. And this is an early really early in the season classic. I think this is just really, really funny. I wish that Fire With Clock Charlie had come back. Like, that would have been funny if every so often, like, you know, like in season 10, you know, he comes back or something. But they didn't really pay too much attention to that kind of stuff. But, no, it's a great show. And, like, I mean, it's again, like I said, it's fun to watch them have fun. It's fun to watch them be like a family and have this thing where they all get to have fun and watch 5 o'clock Charlie drop a bomb to absolutely no effect.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It is fun. And it's interesting how something like someone dropping a bomb or trying to drop a bomb near your living space in your workspace, you know, could be entertaining.
Yeah.
And they go with it. Yeah. You know, and they, like you said, you know, with the MacArthur bit and the earlier when they're going to go watch 5 o'clock Charlie, they get into it. I mean, they're basically dressing for everything. Mm-hmm. They're taking a lot of time for, you know, to do these things. And again, you know, I think that just kind of goes to how sometimes in the military you do have that downtime and you kind of have to do things to keep yourself from going crazy.
Yep. And Alan Alda even gets to break out his Groucho Marx again, where the one nurse runs by and he's like, "Nurse, you're out of your uniform. Where? How about in my place? In 5 minutes." Like, he even gets the – I'm feeling like you were never going to get Alan Alda upset if you gave the chance to do his Groucho Marx. So, yeah, it's a fantastic episode. So before we wrap up here, Max, I have to ask you, like, do you have a particular favorite joke? I mean, this episode is littered with great lines, but do you have a particular favorite?
Oh, wow. You know, there are so many in this episode. I mean, they just come one after the other. It's hard to decide. But I think my favorite one is actually the running gag of the gun.
Right.
That they somehow keep not only stealing Frank's gun, but replacing it with something that he, you know, completely ridiculous that he doesn't even realize. And why does he keep pulling his gun?
That's right.
You know?
Because that's where his manhood is.
Yeah. You know, but I think that's great, and all the things that they keep replacing it with, and you know, I love that. I'm a sucker for a running gag.
I love when I forget which one of the runners where he pulls out like the plunger, and he's like, "What have you done with my gun?" And you hear Wayne Rogers, and he can barely get the line out, and he just goes, "We sold it," and he's laughing, and that really feels like that's Wayne Rogers just laughing, like that's Trapper is supposed to be having a good time, but that's Wayne Rogers just breaking up and they just left the take in, which is great. It's very charming. Wayne Rogers laughs.
Yeah.
It's very charming. Yeah, that is a great gag. I actually could not decide. There were so many great lines. I picked two. I know that's cheating because I like to boil it down to one, but that's how good this episode is. There's two. So one is from the announcer, Todd Sussman, who we mentioned, where he says he welcomes Charlie and he says, "Now, direct from North Korea, here he is for the sixth hit week. 5 o'clock Charlie, his airplane, and his astigmatism." I just love that. To know what astigmatism is. That's fantastic. And then the other one, which, again, I still will use to this day when I can, when they're trying to distract Frank and they've reset the clocks, they've moved the clocks back to – it's 5 o'clock, but they moved them all back to 4:30, and they get Ginger in and on it. They're like, Ginger, did you give this patient his 4:30 feeding? Yo, yes, doctor, his 4:30 feeding. They're leaning really heavy on the 4:30. And so they're distracting Frank so he won't hear Charlie approaching. So they start buttering him up, and they start pretending like they want to hear his opinion as a doctor. And yeah. So they present him this case folder, and he looks it over, and they're pretending that, like, okay, Frank, we're really stumped on this one. Can you give it a look? And Frank kind of mutters, and he says, well, you've waited too long to give him antibiotics, and now he's got an infection. And he looks to the two of them like, oh, I just, you know, I outsmarted you two. And Hawkeye goes, oh, of course. And then Trapper goes, he gets right to the heart of the clinical picture. And I just, the sarcasm in that is so fantastic. I just love, and the fact that Frank doesn't get that. That he just takes that literally. But I have tried to use that at times where someone says something so painfully obvious, and I just go, you got right to the heart of the clinical picture. Oh my God. It's so funny. Wayne Rogers, man, he's so funny in these shows.
He really is. He really is.
Yeah, this is a tremendous, tremendous episode. And this was, again, like I said, it says something about this show that virtually it showed up on almost every list that people sent me about when they wanted to do talk about episodes for this season. So it says something about how good this show is. So, well, Max, awesome. Thank you so much for coming back, man. This has just been a total blast. I love doing MASHcast, and I love podcasting with you. So this is great. I'm glad we had a chance to do this again.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Rob. I mean, I love, you know, being on your shows, and I especially love being on MASHcast. I mean, this is a show that means a lot to me.
Awesome. So where can people find you on the internet?
People can find me here on the network, on the Fire and Water Podcast Network. I look for PlastiCast and The Mirror Factory. Those are two of my shows. And you can find me on social media at Maxwell Romero or at It's Plastic Man and The Mirror Factory.
Awesome. I love both those shows. Very exciting stuff. So if you're not listening to those shows, everybody, you should be, because they are highly, highly entertaining. And I'm not just saying that because I've been on both of them at some point. So anyway, of course, you can follow MASHcast over on iTunes. You can subscribe to it on Stitcher. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter, which is at MASH4077cast. You can find back episodes of the show on our website, which is fireandwaterpodcast.com. And there you can leave comments, because we love feedback, and I will be doing another feedback show at the end of this season, even though we're a ways away, but I'll be doing it like I did at the end of the first season. So please leave comments over on the website. So thanks everybody for listening, and that's going to do it for this episode. So until next week, that is all.
I believe I hear Charlie.
Who put water in my gun?
How do you know it's water?